This episode of the Python Perspective is brought to you by Pierce Duff's Blancmange Mix, a real classic.
But what's this? Two spectators have rushed onto the pitch with spoons and forks. What are they going to do?
They mean to eat the blancmange.
Coming to you in strawberry flavor, raspberry flavor, chocolate flavor, and new haggis flavor. The cardamom, almond, and zest-inflected blancmange mix that you'll travel 77 billion miles for.
And they're eating the blancmange. Yes, the blancmange is leaving the court. It's abandoning the game. This is fantastic.
Welcome to the Python Perspective. Since its premiere in October 1969, Monty Python's Flying Circus has induced alienation and devotion, culminating in 2014 with what was announced as 10 final live performances in the 16,000-seat O2 Arena. On the 50th anniversary of each original television broadcast, we look back at the series and ask, what was innovative material then, what continues to be successful now, and what have people thought about it along the way? I'm Ben, librarian and critic, and joining me is my co-host Nathan, physicist, improv comedian, and actor.
Good day to you, Ben.
Good day to you, Nathan. Welcome back to the Python Perspective.
Good to be here, thank you.
How's your November going?
My November is nice and sunny, like California is known for. How about yourself?
It's the 30th of November, which happens to be the anniversary of my birth, so I'm looking forward to this podcast as a celebration of how, oh, I don't know, 7-8-ish years before I was born, we had this out on the air, which was clearly a powerful influence on me. This episode and I are both Sagittariuses.
Would that be Sagittarii or Sagittaria?
Well, Nathan, according to American grammar rules established by Merriam-Webster of Springfield, Massachusetts, once a Latinate or Greek word has been adopted into American English, its plural form is merely an S or an ES added on. Therefore, the plural of octopus is not octopi or octopodus, if you were to follow the Greek roots, but octopuses.
Oh, you're no fun anymore. Which is the title of the episode we are talking about today. Episode 7, You're No Fun Anymore.
Episode 7, which was recorded 6th. This was the 6th episode to be recorded, and it was recorded just before the hiatus. It was recorded on the 10th of October in 69, and then right before the 2 weeks of them being supplanted, this episode lay dormant. And then when they came back from those 2 weeks, they instead aired last week's episode. It's easy to read into that there were potentially some production issues with this episode or dissatisfactions with this episode that they wanted to potentially hide it, or that there was something going on behind the scenes, because next week's episode was recorded on November 25th. So almost 3 weeks after last week's episode was recorded, there was a behind-the-scenes break. Now, maybe that was a good thing. Maybe it was just the actors and producers were taking the time to be with their families, to have time off, to celebrate Guy Fawkes Day. I couldn't possibly imagine. For example, in Michael Palin's diaries, which tends to be the source of a lot of information from various internet articles, he doesn't publish any of his diaries about this period at all. And then he comes back in 1970, and he states that in part it's because he didn't keep entries because it tended to be just the monotony of producing the show. And he says it would just be, I wrote this, somebody wrote this, which of course is what we're interested in now, forensically taking it apart. But it means that we don't have any clear public documentation about what happened behind the scenes, except for things like Daryl Larson's delve into the BBC archives, where he's able to find internal memos and production notes. Mm-hmm. So this is a bit of a black box as to what was going on in terms of the shuffling of the order of these episodes.
I wonder if there was something going on with the Cleese-Jones relationship, because to me, this episode feels like it's very Jones-Palin heavy.
Mm-hmm.
And the justification for that is they are the primary characters in this episode, especially Michael Palin, who plays Angus Podgorny, who's kind of the main narrative figure throughout this episode. A lot of it is filmed, which is a typical characterization of the Jones-Palin style. But also, Cleese has a pretty minor role. He plays the interviewer in the camel spotting sketch right at the beginning.
Yep.
But everything else is he either does voiceover or he's just kind of in the background in the sketches.
Similarly, in addition to a significant lack of Cleese in this episode, while there's a reasonable amount of Graham Chapman, his character is very underplayed. And I'm sure we'll talk about this eventually, but it is particularly odd that his straight man character of the scientist in this episode doesn't have any particular Chapman-esque flourishes that we've come to associate. Any of the weirdness or the stiffness that we normally enjoy in his performance lays a little flat here. It is a peculiar episode in terms of it lends itself to speculation as to what was going on because it stands out as different from episodes before and after it.
Yes.
In fact, I'll mention briefly, once it starts, we have the camel spotting episode that you alluded to, where John Cleese is interviewing Eric Idle about being a camel spotter, at which point it is gradually revealed over the course of the sketch that...
Mr. Sopwith, aren't you in fact a train spotter?
What?
Don't you in fact spot trains?
Oh, you're no fun anymore.
The traditional train spotter. Actual pastime in England of people hanging out by railroad tracks and identifying different models of trains and writing down their numbers in books.
Camels don't have numbers.
Oh, well, you've got to know where to look. They're on the side of the engine above the piston box.
It's almost a peacetime variation on the kind of plane watching activity that they did during the war, where they needed to keep track of enemy aircraft or worries about what kind of models of our current boys were going over the air so that we would know what squadron was heading off to where. I'm serious. I do think that is kind of the evolution of it, that there was an enormous amount of fixation on silhouettes of different wing shapes and numbers and models that then in peacetime naturally went away, and they had to take that kind of concrete operational obsessiveness and turn it into something more benign, and that turned into train spotting. But it leads to, as you say, the title of the episode and the first repeated gag of the show, which is...
Oh, you're no fun anymore.
And we get this series of quick sketches that end with that concept. It's not dissimilar to Graham Chapman's general being unhappy with people stealing his line of, it's a man's life in the army.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a nice callback to the sort of stuff we've seen before.
Though this is all done in rapid succession rather than spursed out throughout the episode.
Yes, and I really do feel that this is, I mentioned very early in our podcast series that this was coming out at the same time as Laugh-In. And this feels to me in its editing and in its rat-a-tat quickfire thing that it feels like the kind of sketches that you would do in a Laugh-In scenario where we just have a bunch of people basically saying the same line one after another or variations on a line in order to drill a joke into the ground. And I don't think it necessarily works. I remember thinking it was funny, but upon this rewatch, I found it to be kind of flagging that it didn't necessarily have the kind of clever joy that I associated with the it's a man's life thing where it would sort of come out of nowhere. And I think that there's something about the quick succession of doing it again and again right at the beginning that made it feel more like somebody was trying to capture a Laugh-In energy, which wasn't natural to the writer performers.
Interesting. Let's see, I had a list of these things. It's the train spotter. It's the man tied up to the post on a ship.
The vampire.
The vampire, that's right.
And then at the end of the animation that links the vampire and the train spotter.
Oh, right,
which has a military band
It's a Sikh band with the white British officer behind the bass drum drops underneath for a midnight meeting with his lover.
Oh, you're no fun anymore.
I found it kind of cute, but you're right. It does not seem like it's a very novel idea for the pythons to be putting up on screen.
And it may just be something about the timing of it, or it may be something about the production. Let's point out again that during the camel spotting, we have Cleese and Idol up against a terrible painted backdrop, hearkening back to the kind of backdrop that we had in the very first filmed episode, the second episode. So when we have Jones and Chapman talking about flying sheep, there is this very fake set behind them. And this is the same kind of set. It's that same kind of quick and dirty. We drop a backdrop. They're pretending to be outside in front of it, but it doesn't have that feel of the energy that would come from being in a more sophisticated environment that helps engage the actors and the performers in the illusion that they're creating.
Do you think this would be a better served scene if it were filmed?
Well, so last episode we talked about the Johann Gambleputty sketch. Mm-hmm. And I particularly drew attention to the moment in which Cleese walks off stage to come back with a shovel to bury his body. And I think that some of that sketch works exceptionally well because it is filmed in a realistic setting. And so the camera sitting there on the body in the field, Cleese actually able to stick the shovel into the dirt once he comes back.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine doing that scene on a set instead of out in the wild. The couple of seconds sat there with the camera staring at nothing. If it had been a backdrop instead of a real-life environment, all I would have concentrated on was how fake and weird that was, where instead I got caught up in the fact that this is this strange moment of comic timing that I'm really enjoying.
I don't have any notes on this. I'm just kind of speculating. There's no reason they could not have filmed this. Maybe Eric Idle just didn't want to wear the mustache more than once, so they had to film the two scenes he appears on, like, back-to-back.
I also think that there's something about starting a recording session in front of a live studio audience with a set-bound sketch is better for the energy of the audience. Obviously, you're going to have a warm-up comedian, you're going to have something to try and get the audience revved up, but then if you were to immediately cut to a piece of film, which they do, actually, they start with the It's Man and they start with the title credits, but therefore you want to not just go from film to film to film in order to get the audience to care about what you're doing. You do want to have live performers there. So I think there is a strategic importance to having your first couple of sketches be in the studio, if at all possible.
Well, having said that, they would have to do that anyway with the montage of the You're No Fun Anymore, because Eric Idle goes from the mustachioed camel spotter to the guy tied up on the mast of the ship back to the guy with the mustache. So even though that looks like it had been taped on a set, it was then reprojected on a screen for the audience to enjoy at that moment. So they were cutting back and forth between live action and on screen for the studio audience pretty rapidly.
Do I remember correctly, the second time that he comes back as the man with the mustache is when he interrupts the very end of the accountancy meeting about the embezzlement of a penny?
Oh, you're no fun anymore.
I heard that. Who said that?
He did. No, I didn't.
Yeah, it's called the audit sketch, and for some reason the Anglican bishop, or what you call a prebendary, says you're no fun anymore. It's like, ah, you're stealing my line.
I'm sorry, what did you say his title was as a religious figure?
I think he's an Anglican bishop, or it's called a prebendary, which looks like it looks like it should be pronounced prebendary, but it's called prebendary.
Okay.
I've noticed that the It's Man has gone back to, I guess I call it 1x time. He's basically sprinting down a hill at pretty good pace, I might add. And it's a full 20 seconds before he jumps out of the nearby brush to come front and center and forget his line.
It's.
Ooh. No.
It's.
So the timing of the It's Man has been kind of reshuffled again, because he's been getting less and less airtime at the top. They've been speeding up his motion. We had sort of theorized that was a way of just getting through the It's Man to still have the It's Man, but not have it seem so trying for the audience, because it is kind of, you know, an exercise in patience, as we've called it, to get through the first few moments of the episode. Where here, they've kind of gone back a little bit and made it a little bit more drawn out.
As you say, he forgets his line, his one word line. It's like, an actress playing Helen Keller forgetting how to say wah-wah at the end of 2 hours. The basic idea that the It's Man, whose name is his purpose, doesn't remember the name It's and is prompted several times off camera for him to say it. That is an awareness of the fact that the sketch needs something else in order to do it besides just a sped up camera moment. And so they are playing with the punchline a little bit for the first time in this episode.
I have to claim a little bit of ignorance on this. When I watched this in high school, because the audio, like the voiceover audio, is never really quite synced perfectly with the lips, I never realized that it's not him saying, it's his prompters. I thought he was saying it and just kind of like, I'm saying it's, but it's not cutting like it should be. Only when I watched it recently did I realize that he's got this look of consternation on his face and he's been prompt to say it's and he can't remember the word. He thinks they're saying tits because he kind of makes this like two
cupping the breasts
yeah. motion. Well, I thought it was just bad editing that they couldn't quite
no.
sync up the audio with the film.
I have always had a difficulty with the dubbing of the word it's in the segment. It is the fact of the matter that for me has made the joke land feebly more often than not. And it's only because you've started talking about the fact that the footage is sped up that I have finally understood that that's the necessity of having the word it's dubbed in. That because so frequently the film is not produced at a one-to-one pacing, that therefore you need to add that audio in afterwards. That has at least excused it in my mind that it has always felt disjointed from the footage.
Mm-hmm.
So I am completely with you that the audio quality of the person saying it has been awkward enough that one could misunderstand what was going on.
There's also the weird audio edit, and this is really getting into the weeds of this mini scene, is that the off-screen guy says it's, you hear the bell for the Liberty March, and then the It's Man says it's, and then you hear the rest of the intro minus the Liberty Bell ding. That has also been confusing and is probably something that will go unanswered. But I'm wondering if they're trying to make a joke of, oh, somebody has said it's, start the music. But wait, no, it's not the It's Man, stop the music. Now it's the It's Man, we'll keep on going. Let's just hit the unpause button to get the rest of the intro going.
That makes so much sense. I really think that that has to be the answer.
Well, thank you. You're very kind.
So, Nathan, I know that before we began recording this episode, you told me that some of this didn't quite work for you. It wasn't the most successful Monty Python episode. So I'm going to ask, quite honestly, do you have a top three for this episode?
I am a man who's reliable, so I did come up with three favorites. In the grand lexicon of Monty Python, they do not rank high in those three favorites. But in this episode, I was able to find things that I really liked. Not to besmirch the name of the Pythons, but there are things that are likable.
Well, why don't you start us off?
I'm going to start with the audit.
Which I believe I briefly tried to sum up before. It's a meeting of accountants in a business environment with a Anglican priest in the room. And Michael Palin's character is held to, no pun intended, accounts for the merest penny.
Fivepence of a further sixpence was swallowed up in tax.
Fivepence of a further sixpence?
Yes, sir.
Fivepence of a further sixpence?
That's right, sir.
Then where is the other penny?
There are a couple of easy jokes that are tossed in there, which I think are a little bit throwaway. But what I do like is the, what I just call it, monetary gobbledygook right at the top where he's talking about monies. And I did want to talk about British currency in the previous episode just because it's rife with shillings and pence and things that don't make sense to us as Americans. So a shilling is kind of like a dime. A shilling is actually 12 pence, whereas a dime is 10 pennies.
And
so
do I remember correctly from last week's notes that there are 24 shillings in a pound? Is that correct? Oh, I found my old page. Pound is 20 shillings or 240 pennies. Yeah. So okay. Not 24. I apologize.
February 15th, 1971 was the date that Britain went to decimalized currency. So all that would have taken place after probably the first two seasons of Monty Python.
Yeah, you do eventually find references to new pence and new money. And so you will actually have the transition to decimalization take place within the four seasons of Monty Python.
I think what I like about this is the sort of staid, very sterile feel of Michael Palin's delivery. It's very indicative of him as the stockbroker, mm-hmm. kind of like unfazed by things which are exciting around him. And I do like the financial gobbledygook monologue.
Plus an upward expenditure margin of 11,500 lira due to a rising capital investment of £10 million. This firm last year made a complete profit of a shilling.
It would not be a good monologue to bring to an audition, but still. Moving on.
Yeah, what do you have for number two?
Number two. This one, I think, is a fantastic bunch of cinematography, is The Man Turns Into a Scotsman.
You see, people don't just turn into a Scotsman for no reason at all.
No further questions?
I want to point out this whole thing is funny merely because it's sped up.
I disagree. This whole thing is funny because of the soundtrack. In the Benny Hill tradition of sped up footage over a Daffy track, we have the incredibly high-pitched, annoying, keening bagpipe music underneath.
It's the 1-2 punch, as it were.
Yes. We have a man.
Harold Potter, gardener and tax official, first victim of creatures from another planet.
Who walks out of a train station. The camera follows him up a long, winding switchback. He walks towards, we assume, his home. And then a animation of a spaceship shines a slow-motion ray down on him. Because when you have something that moves at the speed of light, you can hand-animate it by Terry Gilliam a little bit at a time. And then he stands stock still and shakes, and then bam! He is instantly film cut, the way in which they used the substitution cuts during the Confuse-a-Cat sketch to replace him with an enormous red beard and a kilt and a tam-o'-shanter and the whole nine stereotypical yards getup.
Walking when your knees don't work and you have to teeter back and forth to move one leg in front of the other, keeping your right arm completely unbent at the elbow out straight in front of you, is really funny when you sped up.
The walk is weird, but the straight arm out thing is particularly odd. I wish I had context for this. We do see in the montage that follows up from this of different other things being turned into Scotsmen, mm-hmm. different other people, I should say, being turned into Scotsmen. Mm-hmm. We have a regiment of Welsh guards that are turned into Scotsmen, and they're holding their rifles in one arm, and their hands are out in marching position in the other. And whether that's some sort of, I used to hold a shield, or I want to keep this far away from the person in front of me so that when we swivel and turn, we don't hit each other. The purpose of the length of the arm could have some actual practical value as opposed to just being a regimental piece of weirdness. But to me, it does have a kind of Heil Hitler vibe to it. If you were to do that gesture today in America, we would assume you were a white supremacist. So to have these Scotsmen doing it as a piece of humor has always been weird. Or maybe it's just weird because when Michael Palin walks away from the train station, the two people that the camera is about to talk to and then cuts away were
the sort of people to whom nothing extraordinary ever happens, and not the kind of people to be the center of one of the most astounding incidents in the history of mankind. So let's forget about them.
The man has a Hitler mustache, Nathan. He 100% has a tiny toothbrush mustache, which is something you sort of assume has forever gone away. I believe it's Graham Chapman, has this tiny little light brown Hitler stash, and then for it to then immediately follow up on the arm straight out Scottish salute thing, it feels very Heil Hitler in a way that I cannot ignore.
I wonder what Scottish people thought of this sketch. I do think that back in 1969, this would have seemed a little bit offensive. that yeah. they list off Scottish traits.
He didn't wear a kilt or play the bagpipes.
No.
He never got drunk at nights or brought home black puddings.
No, not at all.
He didn't have an inadequate brain capacity.
No, not at all.
Not everyone clearly has a big honking beard and kilt.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, just kind of wondering out loud.
It's kind of the Scottish equivalent of the Notre Dame fighting Irish. That if you were to take a people and reduce them to their most wacky stereotype as a mascot, that's what they've done with, quote, Scotsman, unquote, in this sketch. They've turned them into a pantomime stereotype with no characteristics that seem remotely human or subtle. One can only hope that that's the joke.
I will say it's not unlike the American stereotypes you see with Python. I'm not referring to the Native American necessarily, but you have John Cleese as the cowboys. Like, are you going to go back in there? And back in episode one or two, whichever it was. And also looking into the future in The Meaning of Life, where they have Americans being kind of these vacuous touristy types who don't really mm-hmm. know anything but are always excited and excitable. Doesn't really represent an entire people, but it is kind of a stereotype which may play well in England.
And let us point out how the Italians during the Italian lesson sketch were dressed, where they were almost entirely in silk pinstripe suits with mustaches and sunglasses. They basically went straight to Mafia Central casting, despite the fact that nobody in that group has the characteristics of a mafioso. That's still how they were dressed, as to the most obvious recognizable version of something.
Or how the French are typified as being essentially mimes with a beret and striped shirts and black tight pants.
Yeah. Yeah, they're not really trying hard, which I suppose is part of the purpose of sketch, is that if you want to quickly calibrate the audience's expectations, subtlety is not what you're going for.
Sometimes playing on stereotypes is just a quicker way to get to the joke.
Right. So we have a wide variety of men being turned into Scotsmen.
Including a black jazz saxophonist.
Yeah.
Thought that was peculiar.
Very peculiar. I didn't feel necessarily comfortable about the fact that this was one of the first black people we've seen on Python. And the joke seems to be mostly that he goes from playing a saxophone to playing a bagpipe. But at the same time, the addition of the beard and costume and the close-up on his face felt different than it did with the other transformations. Just a little bit extra in there that didn't necessarily sit well with me. But the basic idea that even Mummy can be turned into a Scots man is entertaining, and it does lead to the great tiny animation of the populations of England and Scotland and Hadrian's Wall in the middle, and then all the little dots going up into the top. The joke of we're going to empty out the country because everybody's going to move to Scotland, that is the great heart of the diabolical science fiction sketch, is stupid enough that I enjoy it. This, for me, was one of the sketches that it took me forever to find on videotape, that I'd read at first, and I thought that it was hilarious on paper, and I've always found it a little disappointing in its execution. So I 100% get the idea that when they wrote this, this was hilarious, because I read it on the page, and I saw all the humorous potential in it, and that somehow it doesn't actually click once it's been filmed. And I'm going to zero in on a particular aspect of that in a moment. First, I want to hear what you have for number three.
Number three, the police station.
Do sit down, Mr. Podgorny. I think what's happened is terribly, terribly funny. Tragic.
It seems like it may have been written by Idle. It has kind of an Idle-esque feel to it. He is the main character. His wife has just been eaten by an intergalactic alien.
We may be able to help save a few lives. I know this is the way your wife would have wanted it.
I'll do my best, Sergeant.
Detective Inspector!
And then he smacks Angus Podgorny when he gets his rank wrong.
Oh yeah, that one's great.
I just find that cute. I find it funny, and I like how it's played by both actors. And Michael Palin, of course, sells it by slamming his arm down to the desk with a big honking noise.
Mm.
And it's a selling of the fake hit, which really makes the joke ring a little bit louder.
And I do love the absurdist twist, which I really believed. I really did think it was going to, despite the fact that this is called the science fiction sketch, despite the fact that we've seen flying saucers with rays turn people into Scotsmen, when the cop says,
His name's Riley. Jack Riley, he's that most rare of criminals, a blancmange impersonator and cannibal.
I really did believe that that's where the sketch was going to go. He was so confident that this was a person that was out there that he'd encountered before in this small town. Oh, we finally have the evidence now. Because your wife's been eaten, we can finally round up old Riley. I believed it, and it wasn't until he was eaten, and he very dramatically yells out,
"It's not Riley! It's an extraterrestrial being!"
That I had to concede that, no, this sketch wasn't going to zag. It was going to go straight down the blancmange direction. This is the second person that gets eaten on screen. And when I say on screen, that's a bit of a dodge. Because what happens from the camera perspective is the camera becomes the POV of the blancmange. And a person walks towards the camera and then sinks below frame as there's a slurping gobbling noise. But you can't actually see the thing that's doing the eating, which is a pretty much exact recreation of ways in which they saved budget when they filmed The Blob and the Blob remake with Steve McQueen. That because they couldn't actually do a gelatinous ooze absorbing the person in a realistic or scary way, they instead film it POV so that you're forced to imagine what the monster is and how it works. Which is, you know, it's Hitchcockian, it's horror, it's one of the classic tricks of cinema. But I think it's also part of the reason why when the blancmange actually shows up on screen, and it's a bedsheet on a wireframe bouncing up and down with a tennis racket sticking out of it.
Well, the blancmange is coming out onto the pitch now, and there's a human with it. It's Angus Podgorny, the plucky little Scottish tailor upon whom everything depends.
So I have never eaten blancmange. Part of my attempts at doing research for today was to make a blancmange so that I could talk about it on air and report to you what the blancmange experience was like. I didn't think I'd be able to be eaten by a blancmange and report on it, so I had to do the other thing instead. I have a number of different recipes saved, one from the New York Times, one from the Washington Post, one from Martha Stewart. And one of the common characteristics of the blancmange is that it has an almond base with cardamom powder or cardamom pods crushed up and with cinnamon stick and citrus. The name literally means eat white. And I did find one passing reference to the fact that blancmange is featured prominently in the novel Little Women. So when Greta Gerwig's adaptation of it comes out to a screen near you in the near future, or depending on when this airs, the near past, go and check out to see whether or not there is a blancmange on screen and whether or not it causes the death of poor Beth or Joe or whichever one of them kicks the bucket.
I thought it was some kind of custard, but I did not go as far as to seek one out, you know, for personal safety.
The final instructions in the recipe state, once you've mixed the different milk and powders together and you've boiled it and let it set, that you should put it in a blancmange mold. And there are fancy antique blancmange molds. That part of the joy of the blancmange is putting it in a glass bowl or a ceramic bowl so that when you shake it out, it has these curly bumps to it, like that we see at the top of the bedsheet on the tennis court. But that it takes about 6 hours for it to solidify, and they recommended that you, in fact, chill it overnight. And that, my friend, was more time than I had prep to do. 6 hours was several hours more than I had before this recording this morning. So
blancmange soup is what you would have been enjoying.
100%. And enjoying would have been a very interpretive term.
Tepid blancmange soup.
By the way, when we're done with this podcast, please make sure you go to SoundCloud and check out our new SoundCloud rap group, Tepid Blancmange Soup.
Okay, famed listeners, for the Monty Python Minute this week, there's going to be a little bit of a switch up due to scheduling complications. It is going to be I who probes Ben's knowledge of a Monty Python Minute. And because it is me, I am not going to turn to the random number generator at random.org. I am actually going to switch to a predetermined minute because I have some predetermined questions that I can ask Ben.
I like how this is the turnabout is fair play. It's not just that I made you do the Monty Python minute for the previous six episodes and put you through the ringer with a degree of randomness in order to make it fair. Now that the shoe's on the other foot, you're like, no, I'm going to pinpointedly torture you with a predetermined section. So, yeah, if that's the way the cookie crumbles, this is the dessert, unlike the blancmange, that I will be eating during this episode. All right, Nathan, what is my fate?
Okay, Ben.
Okay.
Your Monty Python minute starts on 6 minutes, 45 seconds.
The universe consists of a billion billion galaxies, 77 billion miles across, and every galaxy is made up of a billion zillion stars.
Okay, Ben, from 6 minutes 45 to 7 minutes 45, I am going to ask you to summarize this minute. Are you ready?
Ready as I'll ever be.
Go.
It starts off with Michael Palin as the compere. He uses British rhyming slang, lager and limes, in order to cut to one man in the dark room clapping, and then it cuts to an animated montage of a series of stars where they talk about the size of the universe in a thing that sort of predates what you would go on to have in the galaxy sketch by later with Michael Eric Idle. Then it cuts to, zooms in on the Earth, and we cut to a song.
5 seconds.
New Pudsley, and then Mr. and Mrs. Brain Sample with the Hitler mustache walk across camera, and then that's for the
time. 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 Well done. Well done. Yes, it's hard, isn't it?
Yes, I knew it was hard.
So the Monty Python minute this week is a little bit different since I'm the one doing the question asking.
What is your pointed stick? I'm sorry, pointed question that you are going to be interrogating me with.
Pointed question. The John Cleese voiceover at the start of the science fiction sketch lists that the universe has a billion billion galaxies. Okay. The actual number is a billion billion galaxies, is B, more than a billion billion galaxies, or C, less than a billion billion galaxies.
Well, for it to be exactly a billion billion sounds unlikely, so I don't believe it's A, so it's either less or more. Billion billion, I believe is, well, if a billion is... Are we timing this segment, by the way?
Yeah. No, we're not.
Okay, if a billion is one with 9 zeros, then a billion billion would be one with 18 zeros? So 1 to the 18th power? And that's how many galaxies? I'm gonna say more.
That is incorrect. The actual number at latest check is 100 to 1,000 billion galaxies. Remember, these are galaxies.
Yep.
Okay, second question. He quotes that something is 77 billion miles across. It is not really clear if he's mentioning the Milky Way or the whole universe. But if it were either the Milky Way or the universe, is that number indicative of reality?
77 billion miles across?
77 billion miles across.
77 billion as the possible width of either the Milky Way or the universe. I'm going to say the width of the Milky Way.
The width of the Milky Way, quite possibly. The diameter of the Milky Way is actually quite a bit larger than 77 billion. It's actually 600 million billion miles across. I think it's actually quite thicker than 77 billion miles wide. I don't have that number in front of me, but the width of the universe is 28 billion light years, or around 165 billion trillion miles, the observable universe. So that number is a little bit gray, so the last scientific number that he tosses up there is every galaxy is made up of a billion zillion stars. True or false?
Well, a zillion is not a number, so it's false.
Correct.
Hey!
There are a billion planets. True or false?
Ooh! I'm gonna say false, based on, despite the fact that, like, every day in USA Today, we have somebody saying, oh, we've discovered a new exoplanet, which I don't believe, by the way. I don't believe that we have any idea what kind of exoplanets we're able to detect due to gravitational what's-its from however many light years away. I think we can probably determine that there are accurate gravitational displacements of stars, but the idea that it could be a Class B planet or that it might sustain water is garbage! Stop publishing it!
Yeah, the classification was just planets.
Yeah.
So, but from a logical positivist point of view, you are correct. There are only several thousand that have been detected, but from a more, I'm not quite sure what the philosophical...
A more mathematical model-based idea?
Yes. Basically, the sampling of stars, when we look, we find planets. So if you have billions and billions and billions of stars, you are likely to have billions and billions and billions of planets.
Okay.
So that, to me, is true? With a question mark. Finally, last question on the Monty Python Minute. The first point on Earth is New Pudsey.
Mm-hmm.
How far away is New Pudsey from Hadrian's Wall, which we are unofficially designating as the edge of Scotland? Is it closer to 200 miles, 100 miles, or 50 miles?
The second that New Pudsey flashed up on the screen during the Monty Python Minute, and I suddenly realized I had done zero research as to where the hell New Pudsey was. I should have anticipated this question, you son of a gun. You found me in my weak spot in my preparation for this week, but it's only what I deserve. It's only what I deserve. New Pudsey is 200 miles, 100 miles, or what was the third amount away from Hadrian's Wall?
50.
100.
You are correct. It is closest to 100 miles. Google Maps puts it at 112 miles via walking, but as the crow flies, it's probably a bit shorter. It would take one 37 hours to walk from New Pudsey, which is just east of Liverpool, a little northeast, I should say, to get to Hadrian's Wall.
But at film speed of a sped-up Scotsman, how much faster would you get there?
Well, it's probably about 3 to 4 times X, so that would cut that trip down to about 9 hours.
Perfectly reasonable full-day outing. So transform into a Scotsman, start moving at 3.5 your normal rate, get a good breakfast, and head to the Hadrian's Wall from New Pudsey.
Given a spot of black pudding or haggis, you can probably cut that down to 8 hours.
Right. You'll be there by sundown, just in time to go to the pub.
All right, congratulations, Ben, on your first Monty Python Minute.
Yeah, congratulations. What? Well, I'm not sure exactly how I did there. I got like 1 and 2 halves correct answers out of the...
These numbers are just approximations. Astronomers are known for like plus or minus 30%. So one cannot see this episode and not think about the, at one point, number one tennis player in the world, Andy Murray.
Right.
Because he is from Scotland. So the old derogatory line of Scotland being the worst tennis playing nation in the world.
Turn the population of England into Scotsmen, well known as the worst tennis playing nation on earth.
Was shattered by him in the early 2010s when he became number one in the world. And I looked for any quote from him to reference that character. I was not successful in locating any written or transcribed interview. I did not watch the hundreds and hundreds of interviews that he's given on YouTube, though they do exist. But I could not help but notice that plenty of writers, whenever he would win, whenever he would lose, would always reference Angus Podgorny.
Hmm.
This is after he lost Wimbledon and he lost at the Beijing Games, Summer Olympics, from the Metro. This is dated Thursday, August 14th, 2008. Time to desert Andy. Desert is spelled D-E-S-S-E-R-T.
Oh, God.
Watching Andy Murray's dismal Olympic performance brought to mind Scottish Wimbledon hopeful Angus Podgorny. A couple years later, he again was at Wimbledon where he lost. Still has not won a Grand Slam. Title of The Voice. Article, July 9th, 2012. Wimbledon, lest we forget the great Angus Podgorny.
Now, I'm just going to point out here for a second, the July 2012 loss to Djokovic, where he was runner-up in the Wimbledon men's single final, was heartbreaking. So Andy Murray shows up 3 times, I believe, on the satirical weekly program Mock the Week, as hosted by Dara O'Brien. And in each time, he's seated in the audience towards the back, but mic'd up so that they can talk to him at various points in the episode. And it's really quite fascinating to watch the various comics on stage and the members of the audience be so proud and so celebratory of the efforts that he put into even achieving the runner-up, even losing to Djokovic at that time. There's some serious emotion going on there. And when he eventually wins in 2013, they celebrate him extraordinarily because they say he's the first British man since Bunny Austin to make it to the Wimbledon men's single finals, that his presence there is enough. But what's interesting about that is the word British, is that England is adopting him in his victories. Whereas where you have in that first newspaper article that you're quoting from 2008, where they're saying maybe he should give it up, it sounds there like it's saying he's never going to make it. We should stop pinning our hopes to this idea. But when he's winning or close, then it becomes a national victory for Great Britain as opposed to a victory for Scotland.
There are people on numerous chat rooms who make the point that when he's winning, yes, he's British, but when he's losing, he's Scottish.
Yeah.
I'd like to point out that the last man, I should say, from England to make it to any Grand Slam final and win was all the way back in 1936. Fred Perry won Wimbledon, then he won the US Open, and that's it. For a good 60 years before you have even another competitor get it to the final round. So for England to claim that Scotland is the worst, I'm not quite sure that's an accurate representation, because when you were the best, because England reigned supreme in the British Open, naturally, for several decades from the late 1800s into the early 1900s, and then to lose that standing for the most of the 20th century, that could also be a definition of worst. But having said that, there are plenty of women tennis players who do compete quite successfully, and including the woman Anne Haden-Jones, who makes a verbal reference by John Cleese.
If Fred Stolle and Tony Roach played Charlie Passerell and Cliff Drysdale and Peaches Bartkiewicz, they wouldn't go calling it doubles.
Well, what about the Blancmange?
That could play Anne Haden-Jones and her husband, Pip.
And her husband, Pip, for some reason. I don't get that reference. But she actually won Wimbledon in 1969.
It therefore makes extra sense as to why you would be turning men, women, and children in baby buggies into Scotsmen. Because even English women can win at tennis.
In the, to me, what is a very poorly written science scene where you have Graham Chapman asking questions to the dits Donna Redding, he asks her,
which is the worst tennis-playing nation in the world?
Australia.
No, try again.
Australia?
No, try again, but it's a different place.
Which at the time ran supreme.
Ha!
There are a number, probably 7 or 8 different Australian players. Top of the list is Rod Laver, who in 1969 won all 4 of the major Grand Slam challenges. So it's funny that she references essentially the best tennis playing nation at the time that this episode was recorded.
It gives much more context to the glee and satisfaction with which she says Australia. She's so proud. She's so dumb and so proud of her answer. And it therefore gives it that extra frisson of why that would be the answer that she would be so secure of. Not just because the character is, in my opinion, expertly played as dumb. I think Redding does an amazing job of being somebody who is the worst actress on the planet. And I don't think that's easy to do. I think you have to be a good performer in order to be so bad of an actress. The fact that she's able to look at the camera, forget her line, she only cares about how good she looks. She's so funny at being the worst kind of woman that you would hire to be in your B-movie science fiction act, because she's somebody's girlfriend and therefore she just wants to be pretty on screen and immortalize this moment, but otherwise has no qualifications whatsoever. She delivers that kind of satirical performance so well, and I think it's a pity that it's easy to overlook that is a performance because she's so good at it. The audience doesn't particularly laugh at her. They laugh even less at Graham Chapman beating the crap out of her so she'll shut up.
Just looking here. Yes.
Which is the only saving grace, is they do not find that abuse and misogyny to be particularly amusing.
As a scientist myself, I'm always mildly annoyed when people say, oh, we need to have a scientist on screen. What are the major scientific tropes that we can put out that are cheap? And always dry ice and water comes up because it bubbles, there is fog, people mistake it for smoke, but it is essentially condensation of water vapor. Gives this sort of like, oh, it's chemistry, it's science.
Yeah.
Even though he is
the chief scientist at the Anthropological Research Institute, a Buckley Down, an expert in what makes people change from one nationality to another.
So I am.
Makes no sense.
Don't you think that's part of the gag, Nate? Don't you think that because they're setting him up in basically Frankenstein's lab or the horrors of Dr. Z or something out of Manos the Hand of Fate, that they're turning it into a cheap-ass 50s horror monster movie, despite the fact that he's an anthropologist? It's not even real science. It's a soft science. And it's based on the soft science of transmogrification of ethnicity. That's, you know, so it's science fiction soft science.
Why is he even looking into a microscope? Or wearing a lab jacket? To me, the funniest line is the voiceover.
For viewers at home, the answer is coming up on your screens. Those of you who wish to play it the hard way, stand upside down with your head in a bucket of piranha fish.
I kind of am with the audience on this one. It seems a little slow. The blocking is kind of awkward, and I'm kind of expecting something else from Python to happen, and it does not. So to me, it kind of lands a little flat.
Oh, I am not disagreeing with you. I think it lands very flat. I think it's an unfortunate example of Chapman, and I alluded to this at the beginning of the episode, who's normally so good at wringing laughs out of playing a staid, stick-in-the-mud professional character. He's able to find something in there where he doesn't in this sketch. There's no nuance, the extra satirical verve to his performance. I think Redding is fantastic. I think the idea of the sketch, and you can see the reason why they're doing it, and it doesn't land. I can't tell if it's a direction issue. Can't tell if it's the way in which it's being filmed or the timing, but I also think that there's not enough going on in the performance to mine additional subtext and bring it to the fore to give anything more than just the simple satirical premise, and so that it just sort of sits there in a way that isn't successful. I think the audience is correct not to laugh because it doesn't work on screen. However, I like it as an idea, and I want to root for it. I want to pitch for it. I want to boost it. That's more enthusiasm than it is actual performance.
I like how he asks a question, and she answers, like, no, I meant rhetorically.
Yeah.
And then he makes a statement, and she's like, wait a minute, a whole minute. No, I meant it more metaphorically. Mm-hmm. I like these qualifications of everything he says has some grammatical purpose, which is shuffled into this one word. Either it's a rhetorical statement or it's a metaphorical statement. I wish they'd gone along with that. Mm-hmm. Having that traipse out maybe two or three more iterations would have made the scene more interesting to watch. Because, like, oh, what are they going to come up with next? But they only do it twice. And I feel like they could have gone on a little longer in that.
It's a good punch up because it does seem like that's part of the structure, that he might be doing a liturgy of traditional list structure Python, but that's not where the scene ends up going.
Yeah. Okay, now we've come to the part of the show where I'm going to announce that this is the five top moments. A moment, again, as you will recall, is just a few bits of film, tape, studio performances, or cartoons, which just make us smile. They're not a whole sketch necessarily, but they are just a little bit of time up on the screen that we enjoy. Ben, top five moment. Number one.
Number one, vox pops of Michael Palin inexplicably doing a Jewish accent and saying,
"I want to put the license fee up."
And the audience gives it a smattering of applause. I think jokes about the increase in the license fee are evergreen. What is it worth to be required to pay the British Broadcasting Corporation in order to have a television is a constant point of tension with the British public. But there's just something so very specific about that line reading that is incongruous and uncharacteristic of anything else that Python does.
That's interesting. I had interpreted the applause to be the revealing of the photo of a grizzled old fisherman.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't know who that is. I have no reference for that. But people applaud after his image appears.
And now, here is a reminder about leaving your radio on during the night.
So you're right. It could be one or the other. It could be they're applauding the photograph, or it could be delayed applause to the line.
It should be noted that they make no mention that Palin's character is Jewish. In fact, the only reason I really was clocked in was that I looked up the script, and the script says that his character's name is Jewish Figure. He has a little bit of a proboscis prosthetic.
Does he really?
Yeah, he does. He wears a little bit of a nose elongation.
Ooh, that I didn't notice, and I'm embarrassed. That's shameful.
And he,
that shouldn't have been done.
And he has that kind of stereotypical Jewish accent, almost like
for me,
British.
It's just the line delivery. It's just that stereotypical Jewish shoulder shrugging, what are you going to do about it attitude towards that's the way life is to suffer. It's such a particular line reading that it always jumps out at me as weird and strange. But now you're starting to point out that there are extra zhuzhes into the anti-Semitic trope that make me unhappy. I wish I'd noticed them so that I wouldn't have said that.
I know this is just a moment, but I do want to say that just before Michael Palin's Jewish Figure performance are two very bizarre things that happen. So they advertise, we know you're going to complain about the sketch. Here's the address to write to. There is a written address on the screen, but the words that Eric Idle speaks.
Here is the address to complain to. The Royal Frog Trampling Institute, 16 Rainers Lane, London, W.C. Fields.
Are not the words on screen.
Right.
He then says, let me read that again. A new title card appears with a different address.
I'll just repeat that. Tristram and Isolde Phillips, 7:30, Covent Garden, Saturday, near Sunday, and afterwards at the Inigo Jones Fish Emporium.
Which is not even an address, which is not the text on the screen. That leaves me so confused that for the 5 seconds that Michael Palin was there, I'm kind of lost. I would have to imagine the audience was a little bit lost as well.
Oh, I love that joke. It's a classic way of saying, please don't write to us, you dummies. We don't care about your responses. Therefore, we're going to give you an address and say a different address so that you're confused, and then when we repeat that back, we're going to make it still more confusing by giving you two non-addresses. It's a great way of saying we're paying lip service to the idea that you, as the great British public, are invited to participate in a conversation about what we've produced, but we don't want to hear from you at all.
So I'm going to lead into the second favorite moment, which is literally what happens right after the Jewish Figure, a reminder about keeping the radio on.
And now, here is a reminder about leaving your radio on during the night. Leave your radio on during the night.
All spoken to this weird man's image who has a corncob pipe and a big bulbous nose. I have no idea who that is. Maybe the people in 1969 Britain knew who it was.
Okay, here we go. Here's what Daryl Larson has to say about the photograph. This quick photo of a somewhat grizzled farmer type, coupled with the voiceover reminding viewers to leave the radios on the night, elicit a laugh from the audience, perhaps as a result of the incongruity of the moment. This also follows the license fees reference, and radios were also... He has no idea where it comes from.
So, audience, whereas I'm attributing the applause to the photo of the man, Ben is attributing the applause to the sort of lingering after effect of the character played by Michael Palin, making fun of the fact that prices are going up and everyone hates it.
And feel free to let us know where you weigh in on this. Based on the timing, where do you feel like the audience, are they relating to the frustration of the costs going up and up, or are they laughing at the strange incongruity of the toothless, pipe-smoking, rustic hayseed who needs to be reminded to leave his radio on in the night? Leave us your comments. We're keen to know where you fall.
Okay, favorite moment number three.
You've already mentioned John Cleese as the police officer. I love the whole argument about the fact that you can't call it doubles. If you're playing with five people just because you want to include your good friend, you can't call it doubles. And why didn't somebody play with the blancmange? It's his frustration with simple numbers.
How did you play doubles with five people?
Well, we were.
Sounds a bit funny, if you ask me, playing doubles with five people.
If you've got six people, it should be one game of singles and one game of doubles, and not leaving a blancmange to play by itself.
Look, it's your affair if you want to play with five people, but don't call it doubles.
Just wrong is wrong to the spirit of tennis. We've mentioned it many times before that a frustrated Cleese is an audience-pleasing Cleese, and he really warms to that little bit of pedantic fixation in a way that pleases me.
Number four is the end of the camel spotting sketch, which is the punchline.
If anybody else pinches my phrase, I'll throw them under a camel.
If you can spot one.
And right after that, you have the knight appearing with the what looks like a very real dead chicken, as yeah. we mentioned before, smacking Cleese in the head. Now, I will say I generally do not find a whole lot of joy in the presence of the knight in armor showing up with a chicken. I feel like it lingers too long on screen. He's not sped up, so there's no humor coming from that. Mm-hmm. But I do find his rapid appearance and rapid striking of the head, just the brevity of it, is funny. And I do like that delivery of that joke.
And it does layer on to what we talked about at the very beginning, that this does have that kind of variety show, quick cut timing. I mean, you almost can sort of hear that there needs to be a wah-da-ba-ba-da-ba-wah soundtrack going on underneath. It's that kind of comic antic thing that they're setting up.
Mm-hmm.
And so much in the way that the bagpipes later turn into a Benny Hill-esque extravaganza, you do expect that the next couple of bits with the vampire and with the 40 lashes against the staff would have a, you know, sort of a jazzy poppy, we're doing a montage, and the knight helps reinforce that.
All right, Ben, close us out with the fifth favorite moment.
You already mentioned earlier in the show that we have the sign in the audit sketch that gets turned over. And during the science fiction sketch, we have a couple of instances of signs. Once everyone starts leaving Scotland, we have a sign on a shop door that says gone to lunch, and lunch is crossed out and it's written in Scotland. We have Mick closed on another shop door. these are all quick animated things done by Terry Gilliam. But the sign that really appeals to me most is when the scientist says to his Dizzy Lab assistant slash girlfriend,
"Now, first of all, why would anyone turn into a Scotsman?
For business reasons?"
No, only because he has no control over his own destiny. Look, I'll show you."
And pushes a button which illuminates a television screen that says, with the words, "Only because they have no control over their own destinies." It's basically the same gag that took place during the audit sketch, but there's something about the language. It's a shorthand example of the kind of 50s science fiction way in which you would just hand wave away something in order to say, "Oh, I am a scientist. Let me explain to you how I understand about this stuff." And done in the dumbest way possible. And I do think that it's a nice piece of satire, and it makes me laugh every time.
This episode of The Python Perspective was conceived, researched, performed, and edited by Ben Russell and Nathan Emily. Sound design, also by the two of us.
Our logo was designed by Liana Emily. Thank you, Liana. The theme song is by John Philip Sousa and was sourced by clips from the Creative Commons Archive at archive.org.
You can find us online at pythonperspective.com and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at pythonpod. One word. This podcast is an intellectual exploration of the comic phenomenon known as Monty Python's Flying Circus.
There are things, dates, facts, names, recipes, or data of any kind that you feel is incorrect. Please contact us via the website. We'll post it to our errata page on pythonperspective.com as soon as possible.
Parentheses, if you are Scottish, we apologize. Close parentheses. Again, our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. I'm Nathan. My co-host is Ben.
I embezzled it!
We'll see you next time when we discuss episode 8, Full Frontal Nudity. It's as exciting as it sounds.